Scientists tell us that 14 billion years ago, our universe burst into existence in an extraordinary event we call the Big Bang. In the first fleeting fraction of a second, the universe expanded exponentially, stretching far beyond the view of our best telescopes. All of this, of course, was just scientific theory. But on Monday, a team of researchers announced the first direct evidence for this cosmic inflation. Using radio telescopes in Antarctica, their data represents the first images of gravitational waves or ripples in space-time and confirm the theory of superinflation of the universe and the deep connection between quantum mechanics and general relativity. These waves have been described as the first tremors of the Big Bang. Here on the phone to tell us more is physics professor Clement Pryke of the University of Minnesota, one of the four principal researchers on the project. Professor Pryke, welcome to the Roadhouse.
Hi.
From what I read, scientists around the world are celebrating these results as one of the greatest ever scientific discoveries. One of them said, as big as it gets, and you yourself called it the holy grail of science. What is your take on where this discovery stands?
Well, I mean, it's a really important result in cosmology, which is the science of the universe and how it got to be and where it's going. And as you alluded to, it also has implications for super high energy physics theory. So this epoch that we're looking back to is at a time when the universe was incredibly hot and dense, a very high energy state, higher energy state than we can recreate on Earth using particle accelerators. So this represents insight into physics theory at the very, very highest possible energies.
This wasn't an instantaneous discovery you made with your research companions. Describe how and how long your team kept this secret until you confirmed it.
So the data we're reporting this week was taken between 2010 and 2012 by the Bicep 2 telescope at the South Pole in Antarctica. And the reason that it's taken us this long to publish the results from that data is that we started to see a signal in it, and that required, because the stakes are so high, that required checking and rechecking the data, slicing and dicing it in every possible way to try and be as sure as we absolutely possibly could be. So that has considerably delayed, that's why it's taken so long to get the results out. And really, the kind of belief that the signal was real built up over a period of at least a year.
So how did it feel to notice that on your computer screens or however you did notice it?
Well, of course, to start with, we dismissed it as, oh, it must be something wrong with the instrument, something wrong with the data analysis. But gradually, as we did more checks, we confidence started to build that it was real. And that, of course, was extremely exciting and also kind of terrifying. What if the signal goes away? What if we're wrong? So it took a long time for us to convince ourselves and to write a paper which hopefully convinces our colleagues.
I saw somewhere where one of your colleagues says the odds of this being wrong were enormous. That is, you're pretty confident.
Well, we're very confident. Obviously, we wouldn't have put the results out if we weren't really very, very sure. But there are two ways for it to be wrong. One is that just there's something wrong with the data or the data analysis. And I can say that I'm fully confident that's not the case. The other question is the signal really what we think it is? Or could it possibly be foreground emission contamination from our own galaxy? And there the odds are pretty slim, but maybe there is a slim chance.
Okay. The site where you did these observations is in Antarctica. And what kind of instrumentation did you use, and why Antarctica?
So we use a specialized radio telescope called Bicep 2, which, as I said, is at the South Pole in Antarctica at the National Science Foundation's Research Center there. And Bicep 2, it's a very small radio telescope, actually. It's about, the total size of the instrument is about the size of a person. That is a very targeted machine built specifically to look for this specific signal. And the reason that we go to the South Pole to do this research is that the atmosphere there is incredibly dry, which is very counterintuitive. When you reach the South Pole, you're standing on 10,000 feet of ice, a 10,000 foot thick ice shelf, and yet they tell you it's a hyper desert. So the air above the surface there is very, very dry, and any moisture, any liquid water in the atmosphere blocks the radio waves that we're trying to see from outer space. So that is why it's one of the best sites on Earth for this kind of research.
Okay, and so you received some readings, some radio waves, I will call them. I don't know if that's correct or not. And you identified that as being this inflation that was theorized before you did your research. What is inflation, and how does it fit into the picture of the origin of the universe?
So the basic Big Bang theory, where we, hypothesize that the universe was once very hot and dense, that's been pretty well established for a number of years. What inflation is a kind of pre-stage to the Big Bang, which sets up the initial conditions, which seem to be, in fact, the initial conditions that really pertained. So it's a period of hyperexpansion, as you mentioned, which goes on in the first tiny, tiny fraction of a second after the beginning. And what that hyperexpansion does is it takes the universe and smooths it out. It takes a kind of quantum fluctuation, a subatomic speck in the pre-existing space, and blows it up so that it's bigger than the entire observable universe today. And in that process, it renders the universe very smooth, which it is over very large scales.
So now, here's where it gets incomprehensible for the average person. you say there was this instantaneous, almost, expansion. I read somewhere where it was called a trillionth of a second that this inflation occurred. And are you saying that all the matter in the universe moved that fast?
So this was an expansion of space itself. So nothing was really moving through space. This is an inflation of the fabric of space-time itself.
So when you speak of, people ask, well, how can it go faster than the speed of light? It really didn't go faster than the speed of light.
Right. So in Einstein's general theory of relativity, which is the best theory that we have for these things, it's not possible for anything to travel through space faster than light, but it is possible for the fabric of space-time itself to stretch faster than the speed of light.
Okay, I'll take your word for that. Now, the age of the universe, I think I mentioned that in my opening, is posited to be 14 billion years. What sort of insights does this new research give us as to how the universe and life began, if it does give us insights?
Well, it doesn't really have much to say about how life began, because that occurs in the very, very complex contemporary universe. So one of the reasons that cosmologists love this cosmic microwave background research is because we're looking back to an era when the universe was actually very simple, and when physics was very simple, because it was just the universe was just hot gas. How life began is, you have to ask a different scientist that question.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. You're right. I should not have used that word. How the universe began is really what I was asking.
Yeah.
But so the plasma that was that formed the universe in the very early stage, is that not matter or?
Yeah, so as we find ourselves in the universe today, which is expanding and cooling. So what the Big Bang theory says is that if you wind the clock backwards, then logically the universe must have been hotter and denser. And if you wind it back to about 400,000 years after the beginning, at that point the universe was at a temperature where it was plasma rather than regular gas. So if you heat beyond hot gas temperatures, you actually strip the electrons off the nuclei and it becomes a plasma. Winding the clock back to the first second or fractions of a second, we reach very, very high energy states, such as are generated in particle accelerators on Earth today. And going beyond that is this inflation epoch that we discovered evidence for this week.
Now, if these observations hold up, What's left to learn about the Big Bang and the origin of the universe?
Well, so this inflation signature that we've discovered today, this is just the first this week. This is just the first step. We can study it in greater detail, and that will be what we do over the next years to build even more sensitive telescopes and more targeted telescopes to study the signal in greater detail and to try and get more insight into the physical processes that were going on at that very, very early time.
Though, I mean, it won't change the basics of it. It just gives you more detail.
Well, of course, so the high-energy theorists want to understand inflation from a kind of fundamental physics perspective. So right now we've just gotten evidence that inflation did actually occur. But and the rough energy scale at which it occurred. So now we want to probe that that process in more detail.
And you mentioned the 400,000 years ago. Is that the time period that you actually saw back to with? So you're looking back 13.5 billion years to see these waves.
Yeah, so it's slightly more complicated. So what happens is during inflation, a background of gravitational waves are injected into the fabric of space-time. Basically, because the expansion is so violent, it injects ripples into the fabric of space-time. Now, those ripples propagate through the universe during that early plasma phase, and at about 400,000 years, the universe makes this transition from plasma to neutral gas. And we can see the light from that time as the cosmic microwave background. We've been studying that for some years. What we saw this week is in that pattern that the cosmic microwave background sends to us from 400,000 years, we saw the faint but very distinctive signature of those gravitational waves from inflation.
And other than your suggestion that it could be some anomaly from our own solar system, or not solar system, but galaxy, it's kind of unmistakable as to what you were seeing.
Yeah, that's right. So if we see this particular signature in the cosmic microwave background pattern, really the only way that it can get there is by gravity waves. And really the only way that gravity waves of that much power can get there is from the inflation process.
Now, I also saw somewhere, and you may have mentioned it too, that it sort of helped. I mean, there's four types of physicists realize in the present universe, there's four types of energy or four types of matter or whatever. I'm speaking from a layperson's point of view, but before the inflation or at the time of the inflation, it was all one force. Isn't that right? Or sort of the unified theory. Does this help at all explain the one theory of everything?
Right. So as you're alluding to, as you go up to higher and higher energy scales, we believe that the forces of nature become unified. And we've actually seen this with the electromagnetic and weak force, for instance, in particle accelerator experiments. We've seen that unification occur. But the belief is that at a sufficiently high energy, all four forces of nature become unified, including gravity, the last one to do so. And at the energy scale where these gravity waves are coming to us from, that is around the energy scale where it's hypothesized that that grand unification occurs. So getting insight into physics at this scale is tremendously important because it may guide the theorists as they search for that grand unified theory, that theory of everything.
For our listeners, we are speaking with Professor Clement Prake, a physics and astronomy professor from the University of Minnesota, about some recently announced research concerning the origin of the universe and the inflation, the initial inflation that had been theorized before and is now seems to be confirmed. Now, picking up on some things I think I read that you commented on before, is it true that we can never go back before this inflation or before the Big Bang, so we can never know what was going on? Because observationally, it would be impossible.
Well, that's not completely clear. So, you know, in the aftermath of this discovery, there's been a lot of discussion. Some of the inflationary theorists find the idea of multiverses very appealing, where there was some pre-existing space and the bubble that became our universe, you know, went through a burst of inflation, but possibly other bubbles also went through bursts of inflation and became other universes. Now, I don't like such theories very much if they don't have any observable consequence. So the question is still not completely settled as to whether there might be observable consequences of these other universes within our universe. If there are not, then it's really a matter of metaphysics.
Right, it's kind of fun to speculate about. However, yeah. You have to admit, I mean, logically, the way humans think, we think, well, there can't be a time when there was nothing. So we have to assume that outside of this...
Well, be careful. So when we talk about the expansion and the inflation, we're talking about processes that create space-time, expansions of space-time. So we have to give up our human linear concept of time, that, you know, there always had to be a time before. If there was no space-time, then there's no time, and there was no before.
Yeah, I knew that. I just I wanted to hear you tell me that. I mean, I don't understand that in real human terms, but I understand that that is an explanation that you must have to have. Now, what I'm wondering now is, does Neil deGrasse Tyson have to go back and retape Cosmos now, that the big program that he just put together?
Well, I'm sure there must be an episode in there that may be slightly out of date now. Yeah, I'm sure. I expect it'll update it. I'm not sure.
No, I'm sure that's true. It's incredible from what I read about what you guys have done. And I wonder if you can put it in relation to other scientific discoveries. What is it equivalent to or similar to?
Oh, I'm not sure that I should be the one to judge that.
What have you heard other people say?
Oh, I can't speculate. But in the late 90s, there was the discovery of dark energy that you may have heard of. The discovery that the expansion of the universe actually appears to be accelerating. And I would say this is a discovery that's at least on that order. More than that, I don't like to say.
That's fair. do you have anything else you'd like to add that our listeners that I haven't asked you about? I mean, there's a million things, of course, but that you particularly would like to say about what listeners should take away from this?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think one thing to emphasize is that bigger is not necessarily better. This was a relatively small and relatively inexpensive experiment, but by targeting it very specifically to a particular target, we were able to make this discovery, relatively quickly and inexpensively. So I guess that's an interesting lesson from it.
Small things can lead to very big things.
Bigger is not necessarily better. But in a way, we were lucky, right? We built this very targeted experiment. Had we not found the signal that we were looking for, then, you know, we didn't have, the ancillary science was pretty small.
Sure. But did you yourself go down to the observatory in Antarctica?
Yeah, I've been many times. I think I've been every year but two since 1999.
Really?
Yeah, I've spent more than a year of my life down there.
Oh, well, we certainly very much appreciate what you've done in terms of your research, but also for taking time out of your incredibly busy schedule to join us here and help our listeners understand some of the amazing things you and your colleagues have discovered. Thank you very much, Professor Pryke, for joining us here on the Roadhouse today.
Okay, you're very welcome.
Good luck. Thank you.
All right, thank you.